Good morning. Hello, welcome to today's convocation. My name is Zina Daldar. I'm a senior psychology major. It's a pleasure to introduce Mr. Jetson, an alumnus whose life story illustrates that lives take on new and unexpected directions. As a Carleton student, John drew together his diverse interests in art, psychology, and photography to help form Carleton's first film studies program. Though he majored in psychology, John graduated from Carleton with honors for his independent work in film and other cinematography. After Carleton, John pursued a PhD in child psychology, but a summer job at KSTP-TV changed his life's course. Leaving the laboratory behind him, John commenced a career in television news, work that would take him to the far corners of the world and face-to-face with the best and worst of humanity. Encountering the unexpected during his journeys, John has great stories and anecdotes to share. For instance, there's a story about trying to escape from the secret police one night through the slums of Alexandria, Egypt. Imagine having no headlights, a wheezy old Mercedes, and a driver trying to avoid rats the size of cats running around the streets. John joined NBC in May 1973. He received three Emmy nominations in the early 1970s and an Emmy in 1975 for cinematography on a five-part series for Ironworkers. Over the years, stories he has photographed have won DuPont's, Peabody's, and other prestigious awards for Nightly News, Today, Dateline, and other magazine news shows and documentaries. Please join me in welcoming John Jetson, class of 1969, back to Carleton College.
Thank you very much. I've been losing my voice a little bit. I'm not accustomed to talking this much for so long for so many days in a row. I'm going to divide my presentation up into three parts. I'm going to show a couple of pictures here that just show you a little bit about some of the things I've done and where I've gone, and then I actually have like a real speech that I'd like to give. I think it's pretty interesting. Bear with it. And then when I finish, it's not that long. At the end of that, we'll go back to some other pictures, and we'll have time at the end for Q&A, which I hope you all participate in. The picture you see on the screen was taken in 1972, which is about 3 years out of Carleton. This is a very vintage photograph. I don't think I have any other pictures of that same time period. This is when I was working for KSTP, working as what's called a one-man band. You see, I have the camera, I have the sound, and I'd be doing light if it was dark. We're covering floods in northern Minnesota. And about 2 years later, this is on a hillside outside of Jerusalem. You can pretty much see the age of the people I'm working with. I talk about that. And for people who have been in the media, when they talk about carrying around the tripod, they talk about carrying the sticks. Well, if you check it out, that's because they were made of wood. This is a picture about that same time in the back streets of Jerusalem. And this is 5 years out of Carleton College, so it's a pretty interesting place to be that soon out of school and really doing what you really like. This is in the Golan Heights. You know, the Arab-Israeli War in the 70s was the only time that you could actually take a limo to the front, do your story, and then record your track and put your story together poolside at the Tel Aviv Hilton. This is in Belfast. And this picture doesn't tell you how close we were to this. This is a wide-angle lens. I was filming in the window, and we knew this bomb was going to go off. It was one of those nitrate bombs where there's 200 pounds of nitrates with a fuse that the IRA used to instill fear in everyone with. This is taken with a 24-millimeter lens that the reporter next to me was in the window. When that bomb went off, I was like blown back about a foot, and you could feel the heat blast, and it's like, wow, glad there's no shrapnel. This is one of the stories we're working on about the British presence in Northern Ireland. I don't know how I'm doing this, but sort of maintaining my balance, shooting and smoking a pipe. Somebody said that there's some Carlton experience for that, but I'm not quite sure what that is. I got to go to some pretty interesting places. These are the Great Pyramids in Giza, which is a suburb of Cairo. It's where the Sphinx is, this big pyramid. Sort of behind me and to the left of it is where the Sphinx is, and there's a smaller pyramid. And there's actually a grave robber's tunnel where you can go all the way in, which I tried to do until the claustrophobia of thinking 4,000 years of rock was sitting there and it could collapse at any time, and that's, I was too young to spend time in there. This was a jerry-rigged thing we put together when the hostages returned from Iran at West Point. I was the guy up on the hill that had the wide shot of West Point with this 50-to-1 sports lens we taped together to one of my regular cameras and a little microwave dish and a generator. And I made the shot that zoomed in until I had the front of the bus that said, "Welcome hostages," as they wound their way on the way to the auditorium at West Point. This is the reunification of Germany, Potsdamer Platz, back in 1990. I covered that with Tom Brokaw. And you'd always tell who the West Germans were and the East Germans were. The West Germans were drunk and smiling and celebrating. The East Germans were just drunk. TWA 800. I covered all the big plane crashes, TWA 800, the 1011 that went down in Nova Scotia, Egypt Air. You know, living 10 minutes from Newark Airport or Teterboro and having all my equipment with me all the time and packed, that was the thing of my job. You know, I had a suitcase sort of like half packed, and depending where you're going, you either put in warm weather clothes or cold weather clothes or sometimes both at the same time. The one trip that I took went from Israel to Spain to Northern Ireland in June, so I had T-shirts and shorts. Well, it was 42 degrees in Northern Ireland, and actually, the only coat I had was this leather coat that I had made in Israel, sort of like a yak coat. It was white leather and, you know, these long woolly sheep. Made quite an impression on the northern Irish, where to them a bright color was olive. So I met some interesting people along the way, a close personal friend, Yasser Arafat, Paul McCartney. And we actually got to touch Mickey, which is a no-no. That's, you know, you go to Disney World, you cannot touch those characters. Woody Allen, who was not having a good time at the time. And some other characters, which were fun to be with. This is at the Grammys with Perry and Tyler from Aerosmith. And some other pictures with Sting and Meatloaf and... I've done a lot of celebrities over the years. And I've shot a lot of operations. For some reason, you know, the sight of blood doesn't really bother me that much. Well, one thing, the viewfinder in a video camera's black and white, which helps. You know, I always thought, you know, if you could cut up a chicken and it didn't bother you, you know, operations like pretty much the same thing. I spent 3.5 weeks at Ground Zero, 9/11. Long days, not a lot of sleep. And we got pretty close. And actually, it was all the way down in the hole. And a pretty interesting experience that, you know, takes you through a whole flood of emotions. I don't know if many of you know, but today's the 30th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. 5 years ago, in 2000, I was in Saigon, and this is Ho Chi Minh Square. To the left is the Rex Hotel, where the U.S. Command used to announce body counts, which was their way of describing how well they were doing in the war. We did a show there with Matt Lauer. It was one of Matt Lauer's Where in the World is Matt? It was Matt Lauer and John McCain. It was a whole show about Saigon. They'd gone up to Hanoi and shot the prison, the so-called Hanoi Hilton, where he was kept. And it was a very interesting show. This is like a really special, it always got cloudy in the afternoon, either rained, it almost rained or rained. So the clouds had come through, and all of a sudden the sun came out, and I was building this crane camera that I do, and I said, "Here, somebody take this picture, because this is only going to last about 2 minutes." So they snapped it off, and sure enough, 3 minutes later, it was cloudy again. So this just gives you a little bit of a taste where we're going to go, but I am going to give my speech. So we'll just kill this for a second. When I was invited to give this talk, I wondered what you guys might want to hear about. 30-something years ago, I was sitting where you are now, well, mainly because convo was mandatory. Well, thanks for coming of your own free will today. So, how did I get from sitting down there to standing up here? I guess I'm still Carlton's only network news cameraman, although others have gone into journalism. The ones I know best are Michael Gartner, who was president of NBC News for a while and still heads a paper in Iowa, and Garrick Utley, a longtime correspondent. Both were graduates of Carlton in the early 60s. I always liked working in my end of the business, the visual side, maybe because it was what I did best. You see, I found out about 3 years ago that I suffer from ADD, or attention deficit disorder, where all stimuli and thoughts hit the psyche with about the same intensity. So I have to pay the phone bill. What was that car door slam? Tick, tock, tick, tock. I think I'm thirsty. Where's my black pen? Is that a bird? Or all about the same? Learning about ADD explained a lot about the way my life had gone. Studying had been a major struggle. Every little sound was a distraction. People talking, a door slam, music from somewhere. It could be anything. I envied people who could study in their rooms. I'd have to sneak off into the night to find some absolutely silent nook on the top floor of Laird or some basement with hissing pipes to get any work done. I could spend hours trying to study at one of those desks by the window in the library. Everybody else could, only I would find myself staring out the window. Clouds wandered across the skies. I watched cars move down the highway and disappear over the hill. What was down that road? It was such a big world out there, and I was sitting in the middle of nowhere and hadn't seen any of it. Little did I know then the places I would go, the stories I would tell and the experiences I would have, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I'd seen the best a man can be and the worst. I've met heads of state, Nobel laureates, stars, writers, the incredibly poor, the helpless, the mean of spirit, and saints. I've enjoyed caviar on private jets and found myself throwing up from the smell of rotting bodies during the war. I have many memories of the 35 years I've spent telling stories. I remember sitting on a porch outside a dusty little town called Ismailia near the Suez Canal in Egypt, watching the freighters in the amber light of late afternoon work their way through the canal. The man next to me said, "Each of those ships pays me $7,000. I guess dredging the canal was really worth it." It was Anwar Sadat, then president of Egypt. I was covering the transition in 1977 of Egypt's move away from the Soviet Union and into the alliance with the U.S. We had wrapped our interview with him, and I was putting away my gear. As I lit my pipe, I heard a voice behind me say, "I see you smoke a pipe. So do I. Could I try some of your tobacco? All I can get is this Dunhill stuff from London." So that was a charming man, and I liked him. Waving off his security guards, he invited me to join him on the terrace of his palace, one of the 14 homes he had around the country. We smoked, and we talked about the interesting blends of tobacco you could put together as a pipe smoker. "Keep it," I said. "I can get more." He gave me his Dunhill to tide me over. Then we went on to talk about his plan for Egypt, how he was trying to drag his people out of the Middle Ages and into the 20th century. It wasn't easy. "The fundamentalists are a real problem. A real problem," he said, looking off into the distance. He knew his life was in danger, but he wasn't about to hide from them behind the walls of his palaces. Sadly, he was assassinated a year later. My camera has taken me throughout the country and to some far-flung places around the world. I've sat with presidents in the White House and shared a refrigerator carton with the homeless. I just missed getting blown up in Belfast when the BBC building was leveled and ducked chunks of concrete in a kibbutz I was filming when it was shelled in the Golan Heights. It hasn't all been nonstop excitement. There have been mind-numbing hours and days of stakeouts in the cold and the rain, gear breaking down at the worst possible time, stories cut poorly. Stories that got on the air weren't the ones you thought you shot in the field, but I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. I came to Carlton in the fall of 1965, from a suburban high school in New Jersey with the Jersey accent to prove it. Born in Europe of immigrant parents, I was the oldest of five. My parents never had much of a chance for an education during the war, and I learned years later that my father could neither read nor write, though he made a great show of reading the paper. We embraced the customs of our new country and did our best to be good Americans, to blend in. McCarthyism was rampant in the early 50s. Assimilating to the norm was considered a worthy goal in our house. You didn't want to be different and stand out, especially if you were from the old country. I had not traveled much outside my home state, except for a few tantalizing trips to New York City. My worldview and experiences were formed by a school system almost 99% white and middle class. Diversity? What's that? I had to fight to get my parents to allow me to attend Carleton. After all, what was wrong with the state university? I remember getting on the bus to Minneapolis with my two footlockers of stuff. If I wanted to go to Carleton, I was on my own. Carleton was a world away, but I had high hopes for the future. Familiar scenery drifted away as the bus droned on into the night, and I realized this was a one-way trip because the person going would not be the same one coming back. The complacent Leave It to Beaver 50s were over, and Camelot was cut short by an assassin's bullet. The Vietnam War separated us, pitted us against them. Don't trust anyone over 30. The Great Society was not so great, and there was much work to be done. Was college irrelevant? Should I have been working for justice in the real world? I realized early on that I saw the world in a different way from my friends. Light spoke to me and shapes revealed themselves in a visceral language that excited my senses. I had found a medium to record that excitement, to capture that nuance so it could be experienced again and again. Photography spoke to me with a resonant voice whose language was foreign to most of those around me. Picking Carleton was simply not a choice of picking a good school or because parents, siblings, or other role models had gone here. The choice of Carleton was finding a place where I could explore with kindred spirits, where everyone could find their own voice within a common language. I would realize only years later just how special that experience had been. I was on financial aid, and my campus job was pep band director. Beat waiting tables. We played during football and basketball half times. Homecoming was approaching, and we had no coronation march to play while the king and queen crossed the field. What are we going to do? My friend Roger Soli, who was a music major, said, "Let's write one." I go, "Write one?" And he came up with a theme, and we scored it out before Thursday's rehearsal and played it Saturday to outstanding reviews. People came up afterward and said, "That was great. Where have I heard that before?" It's like, "No, you haven't heard that before, really." No, I'm sure I've heard it. It's like, "No, trust me, you haven't heard this before." Everything was possible in those days because of the people around you, or maybe because we didn't know any better. This is the part where I give advice for one who's been there. While you are at Carleton, find a community of friends to feel supported by and find a mentor who will be your guide in those dark nights of uncertainty. Collaborate. Your peers are an amazing resource, as I found out, and learn from their diversity. Take risks, be experimental, and challenge yourself. Get used to operating outside your comfort zone. Acknowledge the fear of a challenge, then take the plunge. Remain open to opportunities, because you'll suffer disappointments both in college and in life. But as a man who knew a little bit about difficulty, Albert Einstein said, "In the middle of every difficulty lies opportunity." Take your experiences and make your own path. Develop your inner compass and let common sense be your guide. I don't know if common sense was guiding me when I decided to do a film my senior year called Through a Glass Darkly. The film explored the relationship between the surreal and the real and one man's journey through the looking glass. A number of us have been studying film on our own in a so-called free school film class, a not-for-credit discussion group. Well, we argued a lot about film theory and the right way to make a film. It became increasingly clear to me that I had to make a film to illustrate my ideas. So I talked Vern Bailey and Jake Jacobson into being my advisors, and I was off. Sold everything I owned, which wasn't much, to buy a small Super 8 camera whose outstanding feature was the ability to crank the film back to do lap dissolves if you faded the overlapping shots in and out correctly, because you got kind of like one chance to do it. Don't forget, this was 1969, long before videotape and easy computer editing. Sync sound was not easy, and you had to glue the shots together. I begged, borrowed, or mooched everything else I needed. I got costumes and lights and makeup and even a couple of actors from the theater department, recording equipment and a couple of engineers from the radio station, and a cast of thousands, including Paul Hager, who was in high school at the time. We would shoot in the middle of the night, setting up these elaborate shots with massive amounts of gear, while I shot with this little camera the size of my fist. People tried to study until their scene came up. Remember once, 2 a.m., there were people like draped everywhere in here. But it was hard not to get caught up in the excitement of some of the really big scenes, like the witch appearing, walking out of the flames on Druid's Hill, which is now called Hill of the Three Oaks, walking toward the camera with the tension of a voice and electronic soundtrack building, and then showing up again after a snap zoom to the back doors of Skinner Chapel flying open to reveal an apparition, floating in a sea of light. My own personal Gone with the Wind. I never thought small. People had seen that film and remember those scenes today. I had indeed found my voice. See, film for me is a language that speaks on many levels to many people all at the same time. It is both specific and vague, illuminating our ideas even as they seem lost in murky vision. The camera's lens is less an extension of our eye than a window into our subconscious mind with all of its riches and tangles. The message of the film is never literal because it speaks to the emotions before the intellect. Understanding is a process. The human mind hates ambiguity and must assign meaning before it consider a perception or idea. I learned that my junior year with a study I did for a linguistics and verbal learning course. I'd put together a nonsense language using consonant, vowel, consonant trigrams generated by a computer, yielding words like FACWAS, FERDAP, RELWAT, COMPTUS. Turned out the subjects in my study, freshmen in this case, had assigned meaning to these words to be able to perform the linguistic transformations required in this test of linguistic theory. Questions after the test, they all knew for themselves what a RELFIT was, or a COMPTUS. It wasn't the same for everybody, but is no longer nonsense. For some time after, graffiti spray-painted in the women's dorm tunnels proclaimed, "I've been FERDAPT." It had become metaphorically and literally an underground language. We see pictures in Rorschach inkblots and imagine stories in any combination of images strung together in MTV videos. You can take any 12 random shots, edit them together, and someone can tell you what it means. Take those same 12 shots and re-edit them into a different sequence, and that'll be a story as well. Talking about meaning tells us as much about ourselves as it does about what we perceive. Film for me was fascinating. I truly found my voice. The film I made as an independent study my senior year would prove to be the turning point in my life. I knew what I wanted to do, just wasn't quite sure how to get there. The late 60s, when I was at Carleton, was a time of major social unrest with colleges and universities being at the forefront of the debate. Hide from the war in the ivory tower, or fight in the streets for social justice and against the military-industrial complex waging the war in Vietnam. Salvos were fired from both sides, but it turned out this furious debate rested on a false choice. Serve the field of inquiry or serve the world. Both sides were right. Those in college serve society best when they produce new knowledge in their fields. Produce this knowledge, they need protection from the marketplace, which values only what it can measure, and from society as well, with its short-term focus on today's desires and needs. In a marketplace where the bottom line is king, and what did you do for me today, our barometers of worth, and where we know the price of everything and the value of nothing, college is one of the few institutions left that honors other dimensions of the human spirit. It turns out the engine of our economic growth is a result of individual enterprise and creativity fostered in the academy. Look how the world has changed through technology. Computers, the internet, mapping the genome. All work started in colleges and universities. So the saying, know the truth and the truth will set you free, translates for the scholar more realistically into "the pursuit of truth will set you free, free of the limited range of habitual thought and the narrow world of understanding only one culture. But knowing is not enough. This knowledge must find its way out of the ivory tower and into the outside world, not just for economic benefit to society, but to set an example." Ralph Waldo Emerson considered the meaning and function of the intellectual in his essay, The American Scholar. He put forth his idea of the one man or complete person who embodied all that was potential and actual. He could have been talking about the goals of a liberal arts education. This man was part farmer, part professor, priest, scholar, statesman, soldier. For Emerson, the whole man was a kind of a Renaissance man, but one with an obligation to communicate what he had learned and created to the outside world. It was not enough to only share with other intellectuals. The whole man was an activist. He took what he had learned, what he'd become, went out into the world to share it. I wanted to be that activist after graduating from Carleton, but I received my draft notice. The Vietnam War was still raging, and I wanted to remain a whole man, so grad school looked pretty good. The summer after my first year at the University of Minnesota, I met a cameraman from KSTP-TV while we were working on a film for Concerned Psychologists of Minnesota. He helped me land a tryout at the station on the basis of my graduating from Carleton with honors in film. They'd fired a bunch of guys, so there was space available. Never mind, I had never seen a 16-millimeter camera up close, much less shot with one. So my first day, Stanley Hubbard Sr., the owner, told me my hair was too long. I'd just gotten it cut 2 days before. Took me up to his office and played me his Voices of Communism record, just to let me know what his politics were. So I thought to myself, what kind of place is this? But they were giving me cameras, real cameras, and film, and they were even paying me. Didn't get any better than that, I thought, so I figured I'd give it a shot. First couple of weeks were shaky. How do you load that camera again? Loop. But I had a mentor in Skip Nelson, head photographer at Hubbard Broadcasting, who thought I showed promise. He challenged me and let me make mistakes, then helped me to rise above them. What we did wasn't a job for either of us. We were photographers, and it was our calling. We were storytellers, and it was our job to engage the audience. At the end of the summer, I went back for my second year of graduate school and worked at KSTP on weekends. The draft lottery was instituted that fall, and getting a high number meant I probably would not be called. So I left the PhD program, much to the chagrin of my parents, and went to work in TV full time. They thought it was a big mistake. Dr. John Jeffson had a nice ring to it, especially for people who had never finished grammar school. Well, they got over it when I received the New York Local News Emmy 4 years later. Then it was okay. Then my mother started watching the other channels because she'd see me in the cutaways of other stories. I learned much at KSTP because I was able to experiment and push the envelope. And did we ever push the envelope? I don't know how, but reporter J.B. Eckert and I convinced the news director to let us do a Good Friday story on how television would have covered the crucifixion. Easter was coming, and this was a fresh idea, really fresh. I'll never forget the look on the news director's face when we approached him with the idea. The story was filmed using footage I made of the statues in a local church depicting the Stations of the Cross. The reporter related the stories exactly in the style of a breaking news event. His narrative was supported by sound effects I dubbed in the edit room, matching the scenes he was describing to bring them to life. Hubbub in the streets, crickets and running water in the garden, then the unruly crowds on Calvary. The final shot was the reporter standing in the dark, high-key lighting on him in front of a 9-foot Christ on the cross, the sound of wind the only shot, the cross looming behind him. I'd rigged the lights so that they were all on the same extension cord. I rolled the camera. As a reporter spoke, I jiggled the plug so that the lights flickered again, and then went out. You see, I knew from my sensation and perception course about the eye's persistence of vision. A high contrast image will remain as a negative after image if the screen suddenly goes black, but would it work on TV? I dubbed Thunder and Lightning on the track, so the final product was this. As the reporter speaks about how long Christ had been on the cross, there's a clap of thunder and a flash of lightning. With a worried look on his face, he starts to look over his shoulder. More lightning and thunder, the sound of rain starting to fall. As the picture goes black, you can hear thunder in the distance through the sound of rain falling harder. The negative afterimage of the cross slowly fades on the dark screen. Well, the switchboard lit up. The call volume was 10 times higher than ever before, and positive opinion was running about 90%. The piece ran only on Good Friday at 6 and 10, yet people called for days for it to be rerun. They'd heard about it from their friends. It was an instant sensation. Going to work for the network in 1973 would be very different, much more conservative and challenging in other ways. I got into Local 644, the Cameraman's Film Union, when NBC hired me. That was the good news. That's the union that the guys who do the big films are in. It's a different kind of card, not a newsreel card, but it was like a really big deal to get in the union. And for years, I was the youngest guy in that union by like 10 or 15 years. The bad news was I had to work with these cranky old Local 52 guys who worked in news between features and regarded me as a young upstart and outsider. I hadn't come up through the ranks in New York and was about 20 years younger than everybody else. Nobody talked to me, and I had no friends. Even though the cameraman was the head of the crew, he was not allowed to touch sound or lighting equipment. It was a different union, and they were very territorial. Stay in your own rice bowl, I was told. How do you know when there's a Teamster driver on the job? Well, the shrimp is gone from catering. Union joke. They had lots of union jokes about the other crafts. Having used to doing my own sound and lighting, now I had to rely on the goodwill of my henchmen. I did learn more about lighting from some of the grips, but caught a lot of grief from the other cameramen. I experimented with different angles and points of view. I read about the language of cinematography and tried to apply its principles. My work was called fresh by the people in the newsroom. The other cameramen were interested in just getting by. Their jobs were safe, after all. They were union guys. Everything changed a few years later when videotape replaced film and news coverage. It was a different union with different rules. Working in television news wasn't just a job for me. It was an opportunity to be Emerson's whole man. I took my ADD disability and made it work for me. I would take everything in from a scene or situation, let all the sensations and impressions wash over me, and then make myself focus. What is the story? How did I feel about it? What was relevant? Was I being objective? Then I would reflect on the tools of cinematography I'd learned. What do high shots mean? Low shots, zooms, focus changes. Where do I want to take the viewer? I remember Skip telling me back at KSDP, that's not a zoom lens on that camera. It's a variable focal length lens. When you understand the difference, you'll be a cameraman. Most people are zoom happy with a camera. They don't shoot near enough wide establishing shots or close-ups, nor do they hold a shot long enough. And it's not just the amateurs. To this day, some Dateline producers insist on rack focus shots, where the focus changes from something in the foreground to something in the background or vice versa. They say it's their signature or it looks cool. Never mind it makes no sense or advances the story. In the language of cinematography, rack focus is a technique for directing attention, not just a trick for visual layering. But sometimes you can't tell anyone anything. They know everything. Then one day they're gone and they're replaced by another expert. I've always tried to see the world through the eyes of a child. My viewfinder, a window for his curiosity and imagination. There is a Zen saying about the beginner's mind. If your mind is empty, it is always ready for anything. It is open to everything. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. Creatively, I was having the time of my life. I was getting good jobs, and producers wanted to work with me. I traveled overseas to Europe, the Middle East, Asia. I was a sponge for impressions, traveling the back streets and eating in little dives with my driver instead of the hotel. I loved getting close to the people. Memories of history I had read in the past pointed to the relevance of the modern history I was recording. I learned from the Arabs and Jews I met in Israel that they had fundamentally different worldviews based on culture and religion. Israeli would look at a piece of desert and wonder how he could improve it. Maybe irrigate it, plant an olive orchard, maybe oranges. To an Arab, it was fine the way it was for grazing his sheep. And besides, it was in Allah's hands anyway, and Allah would provide. Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, they looked the same, and certainly sounded the same. But talk to the children. They wanted to grow up and kill those on the other side, settle scores centuries old. It was about economics and opportunity, not religion. Belfast was a dangerous place to be in 1974, especially if your story was the British presence in Northern Ireland. The abandoned streets were eerily quiet as we rode with British troops, but you knew eyes were watching. I'll always remember this wonderful shot I made, distilling the tension of the moment. I was perched on the front bumper of their Rover vehicle, left hand holding on to the tire bolted to the hood, and right hand filming with my camera. I could see the apprehension in the driver's face as I zoomed in, his eyes scanning the rooftops for snipers. As we came out of the shadow and into the light, now you saw rooftops reflected in his windshield, then his eyes again as we drove back into shadow. I thought that was really cool. I loved that shot for the way it captured the moment in an unexpected way. My reverie was broken not 30 seconds later by a shuddering explosion. A building we had passed not two blocks ago was now a pile of rubble. As per our agreement, we had to jump out of the truck, and they sped off to security area. There's more than a little adrenaline pumping as we hoofed it over to the explosion site, thankful that it wasn't yet our time and that we had been spared. I've lost a few friends and colleagues over the years and learned you don't tempt fate. Don Harris, a correspondent I worked with in Cairo in the late 70s, was killed in Jonestown before the cult committed mass suicide. A New York City ABC crew I knew lost their lives when a chopper was hit by a surface-to-air missile in the out islands of the Bahamas while they were doing a story on drug smuggling. Others were addicted to the rush of beating the odds covering wars. They didn't always beat the odds. Many times it feels like you're in the middle of a Hollywood movie, on some set, all this strange stuff going on, everything larger than life. But you have to remember that the bad guys are serious and the bullets are real. I'm proud of the undercover stories I've worked on with hidden cameras and wireless mics. One about Medicaid prescription fraud for Dateline NBC involved building a surveillance van. I'm an old piece of crap van I rented from Rent-A-Wreck that would pass on the streets of the Bronx. Snow tires on the front, graffiti sprayed on the sides. It passed. Sweating in my bulletproof vest, I was filming a drug deal going down about 100 feet away, wondering if the black curtains and dark film over the window were enough for us not to be made. Snipers were in place, and the three DEA guys with me in the van, 9mm drawn, were there to protect the undercover woman who was wearing my wire in that drug deal if things went bad. Minutes seemed like hours as we listened to her mic, but everything had gone okay, and she walked away, and later we drove away. Tape from that story helped break up the prescription ring, put a number of those guys behind bars. I've loved having this huge network audience, doing stories, stoking debate on major issues, teaching people about problems they had no idea existed, exposing the human condition and all of its variety and richness. There were humdrum days, boring days, of course, but you got through them. I did a documentary with Jane Pauley in the middle 80s about a jazz saxophonist named Frank Morgan. Frank was a great musician who idolized Charlie Bird Parker, father with Dizzy Gillespie and others at a new jazz in the 40s and 50s called bebop. Like Parker, Frank fell into drug use and ended up spending much of his life in prison. He did a little burglary on his side to support his heroin habit. When he got out in the 80s, he was trying to get clean and regain his stature as the heir apparent to Charlie Parker's legacy. Sometimes the stress would get to him. He'd get high and miss the gig. His agent would say, Frank, just show up and the rest will be fine. If you show up, everything will work out. Those words became a mantra for my sound man of 17 years, Bob Riggio and me. On days when the job really sucked or things weren't going our way, we would look at each other and say, just show up. Sooner or later, the day would be over and tomorrow was another day. As part of that Jane Pauley special, we shot a concert Frank gave for the inmates of Sing Sing, the prison just north of New York City. He did these concerts in prisons because he felt a bond with the inmates and also took the opportunity to talk to them about beating drug addiction. After we were done shooting, Jane gleefully jumped up on stage and announced to the audience how a certain cameraman loved prison food. Well, I didn't love it exactly. I mean, I'd eat it if that's all there was. The doors at the back of the auditorium flew open, and in walked two inmates with a murder burger tray that they brought up to me on stage to the sound of loud guffaws from the crowd. I took a bite and held up the burger to a standing ovation. The real world is a strange and wonderful place with many challenges and opportunities. Your Carleton education will serve you in ways you cannot even imagine. When everything looks bleak and you think you may not have the right stuff, let go of the fear and focus on where you want to go, not where you're afraid you might end up. And remember what Frank Morgan's agent said, just show up and everything will be fine. I'm going to show a couple more pictures, and we'll have a Q&A. But if you have questions, certainly, bring them up during, and we could talk about them. Done a lot of different things. This is, I think, 1992, covering the Clinton campaign, sort of standard issue, 60-40 jackets, jeans, A lot of these. In this history of things, I look on whether or not I had a mustache and how much hair Bob had, and I could kind of tell where we are. My close personal friend, Bill Clinton. There's supposed to be a picture of Bob and I, and the producer weaseled in at the last second, so she's in it. We had some fun on the campaign, too. This is in South Dakota. We're at a horse farm, and they gave us all these hats and these masks. So we felt empowered. There was this thing the Secret Service would do, and they'd hold this rope from that ramp, and we were supposed to stay behind the ramp so we wouldn't be too close. Well, when they weren't looking, we'd always cut the rope. So like after a while, there'd be like 100 knots in it. So we put up our masks and the thing, we walked up, and we said like, okay, we're not doing any stinking rope this time. And they go, remember, we got the guns. It's like, okay, you win. The weather wasn't always great. This is Labor Day in Independence, Missouri. And my little friend there, his name is Billy Free. He's the older brother of Louis Free, who used to be FBI director. Terrific guy, and just a terrific diplomat. And we'd always get into trouble. Billy'd be the Henry Kissinger and usually get us out. Like this ticket we got for doing 90 miles an hour in northern Michigan. Well, we would have gotten out, except the producer came up and said, what seems to be the problem, officer? Get in your car, and I'll talk to you later. And this is a photo op on the Georgia bus tour, windy highway. They took the press up. I mean, a lot of this is like manufactured photo ops. So we make this shot, and then the buses go by with Clinton for president. So here we are. That T-shirt I'm wearing says, life's a bitch, and then you die. It sort of seemed appropriate. We had some lighter moments. Actually, the hat is a Bush for President thing, and we were in Florida, and I'd gotten the ears to cover it. I don't know. It's amazing. If you were a presidential candidate, would you stand next to a guy with Mickey Mouse ears on? This is one of the inaugurations. I think this is 1988. Bob's got a lot of hair. Still got hair. This is 1990, one of the many day in the life of the White House stories we'd done. Had like pretty good access wandering around. My close personal friend, Hillary Clinton, before the makeover. It's a famous story during the campaign. Gore and Clinton used to like to jog, and Gore had gone out, and now Clinton was going out, and Hillary would ride next to him on his bicycle. So they're going away from me. And Gore's coming back from his run. As they pass, they do this high five to each other. Great shot. I mean, Unfortunately, you got to see Hillary's butt in it big time. It was not a flattering shot. So, and now this shot is like everywhere. Everybody picked it up. So the next day, I hear from her, can I see you for a minute? It was still a great shot. So we did this interview, and that little contraption there, you see more pictures of it in a while, it's called a Jimmy Jib. It's a kind of a crane camera that's remote controlled from the back. You'll see in some of the other shots, the controls are there. It's kind of a thing that allows you to do what a four-man crew can do on a Chapman crane. You do these sweeping shots and focus things, like some of those Alfred Hitchcock shots and stuff. And it's really, you've got to be able to like rub your stomach and pat your head at the same time to do that, because you kind of need to do everything all at once. Without looking at the controls and everything. So my mandate here was, don't shoot my legs. It's like, I'm doing a wide shot. Anyway, we got over it. So I did a lot of Jimmy Jib work over the years. I got to go a lot of interesting places because of that. I used to do one of the floor cameras at conventions back 76, 80, 84, and 88. And then after that, I would do the really nice moves and beauty shots for the big openings and closes, and you could see all of that stuff going on there. Well, now you could like tilt and have the camera go through the air. It was like really a cool thing. So I did a couple of different conventions at different times. This one's in 2000 in California. This is my friend Jimmy White from the Burbank Bureau. We're sort of reminiscing over our careers. Jimmy's the guy that made the shots of Reagan getting shot that you've seen like 100 times, guys ducking and they grab him and thing. He'd been doing a piece on the press secretary and happened to be off to one side away from everybody else. He had like the perfect view of that. I guess my claim to fame was when Jimmy Carter and Sadat and Begin had that initiative for peace back in the 70s, and they got together in Washington and did that famous shot where they're all, you know, holding hands together. I made that shot. So it's not as good as Jimmy's shot, but there it was. So doing conventions, you move into a parking lot and there's all these trailers of stuff and cables and dishes, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of guys that worry about whether or not everything's in sync and it works. There's always an interesting kind of divide between the people who actually did the show and the people who made it work. It's like, well, without me, you don't get on. Well, without me, you have color bars. But we worked it out. So I did old Bud here for Letterman when Letterman was still on NBC. Did some other stuff besides just politics. This is in the year 2000 in front of the Supreme Court when it was deciding who was president. I had done all these different shots. You know, if you watch NBC, you see they have these layered shots, you know, at the Supreme Court, moving past that fountain thing and then up the steps and all that. I shot a whole bunch of them for the Supreme Court, and I did the same kind of thing for the Congress and also for the White House. So they've been using those things for a long time. If you people watch Dateline NBC, the nighttime aerials of Manhattan skyline that they use going in and out of commercial, I shot those like 6 years ago. The director said, these apps are shaky. It's like, excuse me, but aren't you still using them? If you watched NBC's coverage of the New Hampshire primary, saw this nighttime shot of this really pretty inn, you know, at night, and be that nice move past the lamp and into the train, then be Tom standing. Well, what you don't see to the left here is they built this big plywood doghouse for Tom with heat and a big glass thing. So he was nice and toasty, everybody else inside except for Bob and I. And the jib out there with our noses running. Some years it didn't snow, it rained. So there we are doing that. So we got to go to a lot of interesting places. This again, that's the woman in the middle is the bureau chief of the Frankfurt Bureau, of which a lot of those GE has since closed, covering the reunification of Germany. And like I said, you could tell the West from the East, because the West said, no, this is really good, we're all one now. And the East Germans had no clue. I mean, for most of their lives, a lot of these people grew up with the fear of the Stasi, you know, who would turn children against parents, neighbor against neighbor. Everybody was informing on everybody else, because that's how you got favors, that's how you got an apartment. You know, it was like the worst of all kinds of police states. Funny, kind of a funny story. When Carter went to the no man's land when the wall was still up. You know, there's guys with machine guns and lots of barbed wire and stuff in between. And so I was the pool camera for all the networks. So they're walking along, getting closer towards the summit. He goes, "Think you should roll?" I go, "Nah, they're too far away. Let's just wait." "I think you should roll." "Nah, they're still too far away." They're getting close. Okay, I turn the camera on. Poof, the fuse blows. So I took a 4-amp fuse, and I'm going, "Oh, shit." So I put it in another 4, and the 4 blows again. I turn it on. It's like, I have a 5-amp fuse. I put that in, like, poof. It's like, "They're getting closer." It's like, yeah, I know. So I had this other, like, 6-amp fuse or 7-amp fuse. It was totally different. Instead of being, like, round with two little wires that you stick in, it looked like a car fuse, the kind with the metal on both sides and a little glass cylinder. So it's like, I got a fuse, but... So I took out one of my trusty pipe cleaners, I untwisted it, the little fibers fell out, and I wrapped one wire around one end, one wire around the other end, put a piece of gaffer tape on it, and went, turned it on, and it came up. It's like, great, made the shot. And the producer now is like dripping in a pool of, because it's his responsibility, and it's pool, and it's, so anyway, we made the shot, and I look over, and he's like, "Here's the tape." So I go, "Great, I can get my camera fixed." I go back and I give it to maintenance. They go, "Great, we'll fix it." So I get it back about an hour later and I still see the gaffer tape over blocking the hole. And I peel it back and I look, it's my same fuse. They had soldered real wires to it, plugged it back in. He goes, "You got a bad power supply and we can't fix it here. So when you get back to the States, they'll fix it." So the rest of the trip, that's what we did. So that first class FCC engineering course I took when I switched from film to video actually was handy. I did the 50th anniversary of Normandy with the Today Show, and the weather was just as bad as it had been 50 years before. It rained, it was sunny, it was cold, and so with the Jimmy Jib, I was making all these shots because nobody knew what the weather was going to be D-Day, so I had to do all the shots in the sun, then on another day, did all the shots all over again in the clouds, and then on another day, did them all in the rain. So this looks one of the rainy days. This thing was set up, and if you look behind me, that's where Katie and Brian Gumbel at the time sat, and I had the shot. The arm, you see the weights are at one end where the controls are, and at the other end is where the camera is. I would work... this camera would go up and over, and I'd do shot. And this was the tricky part when you were on a big set like there, is go up and over and thread through there and make these shots where you didn't show the stuff and you didn't hit the lights. It was kind of tricky. But I had the cool shot. I'd start up high up here, look past them, and see Omaha Beach, which is down here below. And they'd be talking about it, the 50th anniversary of Normandy. We are there now. And this big pullback, show them, and that would come down to show them sitting in front of that. So that was like the cool open. So that's why I get to go, because I knew how to do that thing, and not too many people did. We kind of need to jerry-rig some stuff to make it work and to keep it dry and stuff. This is at the point down the beach a little farther. To our left over here was a big German pillbox where the machine guns were. They were wiping out all the troops as they came in here. And actually, the only people that made it across the beach were the people that landed when they were reloading the machine guns. So they had to take out this pillbox. So some explosive engineers climbed this cliff and threw explosives over and took it out. The weather had been so bad that all the bombers had missed taking out these German fortifications, and all of this stuff is still there. This is original barbed wire from back when. So when I did the shot over the side to give a point of view of what it looked like crawling up the cliff and then seeing this pillbox, the barbed wire still works. I had some fun trying to get untangled from that. What I do looks really easy with this jib, so like everybody else wanted to try it. Well, after about 10 minutes, they'd say, "Here." After we finished that show, we did a half of a show from Paris. This is Isle Saint-Louis, and that's Notre Dame in the back. And again, as usual, half of my job is missing all these big lights. So for the students who were in the classes, we talked about what you do during daylight and documentary filmmaking. You know, when you have the power and you have the bucks and the money, this is what you do. You just put up lights everywhere to take care of all your problems. Then a year later, we had this, like, really good trip to the Riviera. 5 days in the Riviera. So this is Cannes, where we stayed. And we did a show from Monte Carlo, 2 shows from Cannes. We went up into Provence, to St. Paul de Vence, and did 1 show from Saint-Tropez. And this was a rental that they got from London, this Jimmy Jib. I never knew that they could be that beat up. This is in Monte Carlo. And again, for students, we talked about the sun is so bright in the Mediterranean that we put up this transparent sheet up top, take the sunlight off of them, and then fill the rest with the lights. Saint-Tropez. I covered Princess Di's funeral, that's in front of Westminster. And this is a little town where she was going to be buried, but so many people in media came that they ended up burying her on the estate. The good thing was I got to see Stonehenge. Some of my favorite trips were with Matt Lauer. Where in the world is Matt? This is the one in Saigon. Team photo. Saigon's an interesting place. There are no traffic lights. So if you're going to cross the street, you just start and you purposely walk across. And they all miss you. But you can't like be doing this because then they like crash into each other and they really get pissed. So the first time I did, I go, that's cool. I turned around and said, let me do that again. And you can see, I mean, there's like people doing food on the streets and stuff. I mean, they'd start a little fire, do a little thing. Person would come down, have some rice, have some stuff. Thank you very much. A couple hours later, they'd pack up and disappear. And again, it's really crowded like a lot of Asia is. This is building the Jib in front of the Rex Hotel. And you saw the one before, you know, what the city hall is kind of to the right, the way the Jib is aiming. Well, this is what showed up for our power. And the guy who ran that thing, I don't know if you can tell, in the back of that there's a hammock. He slept. I mean, he was with that 24 hours a day. It was like, you guard this thing. So anyway, it was clear that we had to do something to make that work. So the market is an amazing place. Each little cubby is totally different kind of stuff. I mean, there's like fans and there's like transmissions next to it, jewelry next to that, clothes next to that. Some of it is open air, some of it's in the dark. This is the house electrician who's translating. We actually build a box of like in where power comes into your house, into the main fuse box. We had to build one for the hotel and one for the generator. This guy from Australia and I are building these boxes. I mean, they gave a la carte new meaning. So 3 days later, I had a couple of these plugged into that thing. And if you look, their wires are those gray things, and the really nice-looking wires are the new ones that I put in. So that was a terrific look. One of the other places I really liked was Angkor Wat, which is one of the man-made 7 wonders of the world. Dates back to like 500, 600. For days, we'd be going up and down these steps, and then one day we were sitting on the street, we looked over, and a snake about this long went from the steps of one side and into a hole on the other side. And we're going like, so are those like those snakes that you die in 10 seconds if they bite you? And so every time we go up the steps from that, I'd be like. And then we had to cross this no man's land over to the temple. And they'd said like, stick to the paths. We're not sure we've gotten all the landmines. Remember those pictures from Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge and all those piles of like thousands of skulls? Most of them came from here, where they killed all the French and all the Cambodians working with the French to renovate Angkor Wat, you know, from that whole reign of terror. It's amazing you can do TV anywhere. I mean, there's no power there. It's in the middle of nowhere. They sent the stuff from London, all these electronic packages on the back of this old army truck. The lighting guys came from Bangkok and had 4 days on the roads and that truck on the left. And then that bus on the right, pulled all the seats out, air-conditioned it and made it into a control room. And in this shot, if you look down next to the bus, these are air conditioners that cool the inside of that. So again, those guys got to be where it was nice, and we were out with the bugs, the 100% humidity, and the rain. This dish is for communications. Cambodians thought it was pretty cool. We finally got some tents set up because we were sitting under the tree, like smelled nice, it was really terrific, until one day the red ants that bite you fell out, and we went running every which way, trying to get them off of us. So here I am, like, sweating again. I did that a lot in Asian countries. But they told us about the malaria mosquitoes, and I had these light garments. They were laughing at me because, like, the bottoms are taped. You know, my wrists are taped. But it sort of worked. So this guy's at Angkor Thom, the temple where all the trees grow through the walls and are a part of it. So it's pretty interesting meeting them. And this is the best part of a lot of my travels, was meeting the people, getting to know them, and, you know, spending time with them, learning their customs. So I know that sort of ran late, but, you know, any questions, go ahead, jump in. I'd be more than happy to talk with you. Thank you very much for coming.